Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, January 10, and tomorrow, January 11th, is the sordid anniversary of America's descent into barbarism. I don't know about the dirt cheap part. We've never really seen a breakout of the costs of operating the offshore prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But 11 years ago Friday, it was opened, and it may never be closed. Because the collusion of the failure of the White House to follow through on Obama's day one promise to close Gitmo, the way Congress has passed laws that tie the president's hands, even from releasing those who have been cleared, some of them for as long as 7 years. And now the courts have joined to form what is almost a cement tomb for those who remain there. And what I'm referring to is that the courts no longer entertain habeas corpus suits. They just defer to the government and say, well, if you're at Guantanamo, you must be a bad guy, and therefore we will not hear your case. Andy Worthington is the British journalist who has done a yeoman's job of chronicling the individuals who've been held there, humanizing them, explaining their cases. And as he recaps, here is the current scoreboard at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Peter, there are 166 men still at Guantanamo. So, you know, the prison in total held 779 men throughout its history. So, you know, we got down to 166 eventually. Unfortunately, almost no one has been released in the last 2.5 years. I believe it's 13 prisoners have been released in the last 2.5 years. Now, of those 166, you know, what's particularly interesting, the most salient fact about them is that 86 of them have been cleared for release by a sober and very careful task force of career officials and lawyers from various government departments and the intelligence agencies established by President Obama. So we now know the names and identities, the names and the nationalities of 55 of these men, which were kept under wraps for many years, apparently so that negotiations could take place to try and secure their release, for many of them needed new countries to go to. Mm-hmm. So the names weren't made public. They were made public in September. 55 names. The other 31 people that we're talking about are essentially Yemenis. They're all Yemenis. So half of the 55 are Yemenis, plus another 30. When the task force was making its decisions about what should happen to the prisoners, they were happy at the time for the first group of 27 or 28 Yemenis to be released. These other 30 or 31, they said, they invented a special category for them. They said that they were subject to conditional detention and could be released if the security situation in Yemen was considered to be improved. What actually happened was that as soon as they issued their report, a Nigerian man called Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who had been recruited in Yemen apparently, tried to blow up a bomb in his underwear on a plane bound for the U.S., and suddenly all the Yemenis were put in this category of conditional detention, not to be released until it was deemed by somebody, it wasn't made clear who or how, the security situation would improve in Yemen. And they've been stuck there ever since.
In an in-depth interview we'll release on Friday, Andy Worthington details the status of Guantanamo, the murky alleged suicide of Yemeni Adnan Latif this past September, and the continuing detention of the last British citizen at Guantanamo, a man named Shakir Amer. And I encourage you to listen. We will release that on the 11th. And it's part of an interview package that includes Nick Terse and a powerful new book about America's atrocities committed in Vietnam 40-plus years ago. And I encourage you to listen and see what it moves you to do. And I also encourage you to join the expanding ranks of people who subscribe to the Peter B. Collins In-Depth Interview podcast. I'm putting the drive on, hoping to get those of you who listen to our free podcast on a regular basis to step up and help support our independent journalism, because I need your help. This is a year where I need to generate more subscribers and make this work out so that I can continue to provide the independent voices and strong opinions that you've come to expect here at peterbcollins.com. Well, I've been watching carefully the actions in the court-martial of political prisoner Bradley Manning, and we now have a further delay in his trial. It has been pushed back to June 3rd of this year. And also this week, the court-martial judge in this case, being held at Fort Meade, Maryland, made a very interesting determination. Judge Lind said that, yes, Bradley Manning's initial confinement at the Marine Corps base at Quantico, Virginia, was, quote, more rigorous than necessary. Now, that's quite a euphemism. That's like saying leaving an innocent person at Guantanamo is more rigorous and inconvenient than necessary. But it's an interesting move because in the pretrial skirmishes, Bradley Manning's attorneys have made the case very clearly that he was mistreated when he was imprisoned and that this is a violation of his human and constitutional rights. And because this is a military proceeding where you don't really, as a defendant, enjoy the same rights that you would in a federal court proceeding, it is significant that as a result, Judge Lind has determined that whatever Bradley Manning's sentence turns out to be, he will get 112 days credit for the severe incarceration that he was treated to at Quantico in 2010 and 2011. And I think it is a statement. And of course, if he draws a life sentence, 112 days will be meaningless. But it is a minor victory for the rights of Bradley Manning. A judge here in San Francisco on the federal bench is pushing back, unwilling to accept having his hands tied by the federal government and being fed secret evidence in a case of a woman who is trying to get her name taken off the secret no-fly list. Her name is Rahina Ibrahim, and she was a student at Stanford University. She eventually earned her doctorate, but she was at one point arrested and jailed at San Francisco International Airport when she was flying home to, I believe it's Indonesia, with her 14-year-old daughter. I'm sorry, Malaysia is the correct country of her nationality. And this is a very interesting case because, as you may know, there are American citizens who have common names. Oh, people named Ted Kennedy, for example, who have wound up on the no-fly list and they can't get off it. And there's also a secondary list where it's called a selectee list, where you're permitted to fly after they give you the full proctology search. And nobody can explain to individuals how they got onto the list. Nobody can explain how you get off the list. And the judge in this case has really gone ballistic. His name is Alsup, A-L-S-U-P, and he is really wrangling with the federal government because he said he refuses to look at secret evidence that they have tried to present to him. He said it's time to resolve this case on the merits. And this is a very important point. And Alsup also said that the approach of the government, trying to feed him secret evidence that he can't reveal to the defendant in order to get the case dismissed, quote, smacks of secret government and star chamber proceedings. Now, if you heard earlier this week, our exclusive interview with John Eisenberg, the attorney in the wiretap case that unfortunately will not be appealed, when I asked him if there had been any kind of judicial sleight of hand that led to the dismissal, he said, well, he doesn't know. because of all the secrecy, the government was allowed to communicate with the judge and the plaintiffs in the case of Eisenberg's Al-Haramain case were not permitted to be a party to those communications, to have any evidence revealed to them that was presented in secret to the court. And this is simply unconstitutional and un-American. And to pretend that national security would be violated by explaining to this Malaysian woman how she wound up on the no-fly list, well, it's farcical. And the Obama administration has pressed the use of the state secrets privilege beyond the pale, beyond the expansive standards set under George W. Bush, particularly in the Sybil Edmonds case. And so we are devolving to these lower standards of rights of individuals. And as I've a point I've made many times, we surrender constitutional rights when we show up at the airport and ask to get on a flight. And at some point, we've got to get rational about this, and we have to restore constitutional rule. Unfortunately, the way things are going, we've also talked about the case that was decided in New York last week, where the judge ruled that she would like to order the government to cough up the secret memos that were used to rationalize the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki, the American who was in Yemen, but she can't. And so this is, to me, one of the most vexing aspects of President Obama, the former constitutional law professor, and the way they keep tightening the access to the courts and asserting that the government doesn't make mistakes. And we know that's not true, yet we're told to sit down and shut up. Here is a story of a Texas high school student who was ordered to wear a badge with a radio tag that tracked her movements. She attends John Jay High School, and she had filed a federal court suit and then the appeal of the school's ID policy. Now, the courts have ruled that people under the age of 18 have diminished rights, but I think this is a very broad-based issue, because if they can force a high school student to wear a radio tracking device just because he or she is a student, well, think what they can do with the rest of us. They could add it to our driver's license. They could put the FBI lost a case last year in the Supreme Court where they had, without a warrant, attached GPS radio tracking devices to the automobiles of suspects. And so there's real tension here between the rights of this high school student in Texas and that Supreme Court ruling. But it is another incursion on our constitutional rights in the name of safety and security. And we had another shooting in Kern County, that's Bakersfield. A student was shot at a California high school on Thursday morning, and another student was taken into custody. A male student was shot in the chest area, then airlifted to a nearby hospital in Bakersfield, and another male student was taken into custody with a shotgun found at the scene. Sheriff's office said that two students had been shot, but it turns out that the second student was not hit by gunfire, but had a reaction, a stress-related reaction, to the shooting. On top of this, there was a report from Pennsylvania yesterday about a mom who had been proudly packing her gun to her child's soccer games. Yes, the gun-toting soccer mom. And tragically, her husband, a prison guard, killed her and then took his own life in front of their children. This is so sad. And more than 600 Americans have been killed in gun violence since the highly reported incident that killed 20 students and 7 adults in Newtown, Connecticut in December. So Vice President Joe Biden appears ready to take action. As you know, I've been skeptical about just how much the Obama administration will challenge the gun lobby. But Biden says that he is going to present the president with proposals by next Tuesday, Now, this is very fast, and I'm sure the administration is hoping to take advantage of the current climate of appalling gun violence and the willingness of people to get rational about meaningful regulation. And what Obama is expected to receive from Biden is legislation related to guns, ammunition, mental health services, and violent images in popular culture. And on the regulatory side, it appears that they're going to propose limits on the availability of high-capacity gun magazines and the need for what Biden has called near-universal background checks. And, of course, the people who have guns are hysterical about this, pushing back very hard, saying that the Obama administration wants to take away all of their guns. This started with the Fast and Furious case, and we see it amplified. Probably you've seen at least a clip of Alex Jones' appearance on the lame Piers Morgan show, where he just was frothing at the mouth, continually dominating what was supposed to be dialogue with this hysterical argument that they're trying to take all of our guns away. That argument is compelling to many people, particularly gun owners. And finally today, on the way into my office and studio this morning, I punched up the Rush Limbaugh show just to see what that nutball is talking about these days. And it appeared that he'd been talking about AIG's threat to sue the government because our $180 billion bailout presumably or allegedly cost their shareholders $25 billion in losses. And we discussed this a little bit yesterday. So the lawsuit is not going forward. That's a bit of a relief. It shows that even greedsters sometimes can be shamed into doing the right thing. But the exchange I heard was Rush Limbaugh blaming Jesse Jackson and Barack Obama for the meltdown of the mortgage system and the AIG insurance that was required to back up these toxic mortgage-backed securities. And curiously, he says that Jesse Jackson and Barack Obama, who wasn't even in federal office at the in the late 1990s, were responsible for forcing the government, like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to write loans, and the coded language that Rush was using was loans to poor black people. And he clearly and falsely defined what is called redlining. In the 90s, there was a big objection raised by community groups to redlining, which was the practice of banks to draw a red line on maps and say, we won't write loans in this neighborhood. And Limbaugh made it seem like redlining was about people of lower incomes, and that somehow the banks had been forced to write mortgages to what I call predatory borrowers. And it is such bullshit, but it is the rewrite of history that is accepted on the right, that the meltdown was caused by the borrowers and not by the lenders. Nobody forced Countrywide to issue no-doc liar loans. Nobody did. And what he fails to say is that many of the African Americans and other minorities who have lost their homes to foreclosure were manipulated into signing up for these these escalating loans where the interest rate goes up over time because the loan officer got a higher commission for pushing those loans. And many of these people qualified for standard 30-year mortgages at a fixed rate, but they were told that, oh, you can always refinance, mortgage rates will probably go down, so yeah, just take this 5-year loan and everything's going to be okay. And that, of course, has barely been punished. Some of these settlements of recent days do address the issue in part, but certainly don't make anybody whole and don't help the people who have already lost their homes to foreclosure. Thanks for listening to my news and comment today. I encourage you to visit my website at peterbcollins.com. You can visit me on Facebook, where I post on almost a daily basis the topics of my news and comment podcast. And if you do that, go there and pretend you like me, will you? When you click like, it enables me to post something, and you will see it on your Facebook page. You got it? Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.